unthinkable. It was to risk learning that they already knew. Audrey did not wait, not even a day. The next morning, she showed my email to Mother. I cannot imagine the details of that conversation, but I know that for Audrey, it must have been a tremendous relief, laying my words before our mother, finally able to say, "I'm not crazy. It happened to Tara, too." For all of that day, Mother pondered it. Then she decided she had to hear the words from me. It was late afternoon in Idaho, nearly midnight in England, when my mother, unsure how to place an international call, found me online. The words on the screen were small, confined to a tiny text box in the corner of the browser, but somehow they seemed to swallow the room. She told me she had read my letter. I braced myself for her rage. Note, the language in the description of the referenced text exchange is paraphrased, not directly quoted. "It is painful to face reality," she wrote, "to realize there was something ugly and I refused to see it." I had to read those lines a number of times before I understood them, before I realized that she was not angry, not blaming me, or trying to convince me I had only imagined. She believed me. "Don't blame yourself," I told her. "Your mind was never the same after the accident." "Maybe," she said, "but sometimes I think we choose our illnesses because they benefit us in some way." I asked Mother why she'd never stopped Sean from hurting me. "Sean always said you picked the fights, and I guess I wanted to believe that because it was easier, because you were strong and rational, and anyone could see that Sean was not." That didn't make sense. If I had seemed rational, why had Mother believed Sean when he'd told her I was picking fights, that I needed to be subdued, disciplined? "I'm a mother," she said. "Mothers protect, and Sean was so damaged." I wanted to say that she was also my mother, but I didn't. "I don't think Dad will believe any of this," I typed. "He will," she wrote, "but it's hard for him. It reminds him of the damage his bipolar has caused to our family." I had never heard Mother admit that Dad might be mentally ill. Years before, I had told her what I'd learned in my psychology class about bipolar disorder and schizophrenia, but she had shrugged it off. Hearing her say it now felt liberating. The illness gave me something to attack besides my father, so when Mother asked why I hadn't come to her sooner, why I hadn't asked for help, I answered honestly. "Because you were so bullied by Dad," I said. "You were not powerful in the house. Dad ran things, and he was not going to help us." "I am stronger now," she said. "I no longer run scared." When I read this, I imagined my mother as a young woman, brilliant and energetic, but also anxious and complying. Then the image changed, her body thinning, elongating, her hair flowing, long and silver. "Emily is being bullied," I wrote. "She is," Mother said, "like I was." "She is you," I said. "She is me, but we know better now. We can rewrite the story." I asked about a memory. It was from the weeks before I'd left for BYU, after Sean had had a particularly bad night. He'd brought Mother to tears, then plopped onto the sofa and turned on the TV. I'd found her sobbing at the kitchen table, and she'd asked me not to go to BYU. "You're the only one strong enough to handle him," she'd said. "I can't, and your father can't. It has to be you." I typed slowly, reluctantly. "Do you remember telling me not to go to school, that I was the only one who could handle Sean?" "Yes, I remember that." There was a pause, then more words appeared, words I hadn't known I needed to hear, but once I saw them, I realized I'd been searching my whole life for them. "You were my child. I should have protected you." I lived a lifetime in the moment I read those lines, a life that was not the one I had actually lived. I became a different person, who remembered a different childhood. I didn't understand the magic of those words then, and I don't understand it now. I know only this, that when my mother told me she had not been the mother to me that she wished she'd been, she became that mother for the first time. "I love you," I wrote, and closed my laptop. Mother and I spoke only once about that conversation, on the phone, a week later.
"It's being dealt with," she said. "I told your father what you and your sister said. Sean will get help."
I put the issue from my mind. My mother had taken up the cause. She was strong. She had built that business with all those people working for her, and it dwarfed my father's business and all the other businesses in the whole town. She, that docile woman, had a power in her the rest of us couldn't contemplate. And Dad, he had changed. He was softer, more prone to laugh. The future could be different from the past. Even the past could be different from the past, because my memories could change. I no longer remembered Mother listening in the kitchen while Sean pinned me to the floor, pressing my windpipe. I no longer remembered her looking away. My life in Cambridge was transformed. Or rather, I was transformed into someone who believed she belonged in Cambridge. The shame I'd long felt about my family leaked out of me almost overnight. For the first time in my life, I talked openly about where I'd come from. I admitted to my friends that I'd never been to school. I described Buck's Peak with its many junkyards, barns, corrals. I even told them about the root cellar full of supplies in the wheat field and the gasoline buried near the old barn. I told them I'd been poor. I told them I'd been ignorant. And in telling them this, I felt not the slightest prick of shame. Only then did I understand where the shame had come from. It wasn't that I hadn't studied in a marble conservatory or that my father wasn't a diplomat. It wasn't that Dad was half out of his mind or that Mother followed him. It had come from having a father who shoved me toward the chomping blades of the shear instead of pulling me away from them. It had come from those moments on the floor, from knowing that Mother was in the next room, closing her eyes and ears to me, and choosing, for that moment, not to be my mother at all. I fashioned a new history for myself. I became a popular dinner guest with my stories of hunting and horses, of scrapping and fighting mountain fires, of my brilliant mother, midwife and entrepreneur, of my eccentric father, junkman and zealot. I thought I was finally being honest about the life I'd had before. It wasn't the truth exactly, but it was true in a larger sense, true to what would be in the future, now that everything had changed for the better, now that Mother had found her strength. The past was a ghost, insubstantial, unaffecting. Only the future had weight. Chapter 32. A Brawling Woman in a Wide House. When I next returned to Buck's Peak, it was autumn, and Grandma down the hill was dying. For 9 years, she had battled the cancer in her bone marrow. Now the contest was ending. I had just learned that I'd won a place at Cambridge to study for a PhD when Mother wrote to me. "Grandma is in the hospital again," she said. "Come quick. I think this will be the last time." When I landed in Salt Lake, Grandma was drifting in and out of consciousness. Drew met me at the airport. We were more than friends by then, and Drew said he would drive me to Idaho, to the hospital in town. I hadn't been back there since I'd taken Sean years before, and as I walked down its white, antiseptic hallway, it was difficult not to think of him. We found Grandma's room. Grandpa was seated at her bedside, holding her speckled hand. Her eyes were open, and she looked at me.
"It's my little Tara, come all the way from England," she said.
Then her eyes closed. Grandpa squeezed her hand, but she was asleep. A nurse told us she would likely sleep for hours. Drew said he would drive me to Buck's Peak. I agreed, and it wasn't until the mountain came into view that I wondered whether I'd made a mistake. Drew had heard my stories, but still there was a risk in bringing him here. This was not a story, and I doubted whether anyone would play the part I had written for them. The house was in chaos. There were women everywhere, some taking orders over the phone, others mixing oils or straining tinctures. There was a new annex on the south side of the house, where younger women were filling bottles and packaging orders for shipment. I left Drew in the living room and went to the bathroom, which was the only room in the house that still looked the way I remembered it. When I came out, I walked straight into a thin old woman with wiry hair and large square glasses. "This bathroom is for senior management only," she said. "Bottle fillers must use the bathroom in the annex." "I don't work here," I said. She stared at me. "Of course I worked here. Everyone worked here." "This bathroom is for senior management," she repeated, straightening to her full height. "You are not allowed to leave the annex." She walked away before I could reply. I still hadn't seen either of my parents. I weaved my way back through the house and found Drew on the sofa, listening to a woman explain that aspirin can cause infertility. I grasped his hand and pulled him behind me, cutting a path through the strangers.
"Is this place for real?" he said.
I found Mother in a windowless room in the basement. I had the impression that she was hiding there. I introduced her to Drew, and she smiled warmly. "Where's Dad?" I said. I suspected that he was sick in bed, as he had been prone to pulmonary illnesses since the explosion had charred his lungs.
"I'm sure he's in the fray," she said, rolling her eyes at the ceiling, which thrummed with the thudding of feet.
Mother came with us upstairs. The moment she appeared on the landing, she was hailed by several of her employees with questions from clients. Everyone seemed to want her opinion about their burns, their heart tremors, their underweight infants. She waved them off and pressed forward. The impression she gave as she moved through her own house was of a celebrity in a crowded restaurant, trying not to be recognized. My father's desk was the size of a car. It was parked in the center of the chaos. He was on the phone, which he'd wedged between his cheek and shoulder so it wouldn't slip through his waxy hands.
"Doctors can't help with them diabetes," he said, much too loudly. "But the Lord can."
I looked sideways at Drew, who was smiling. Dad hung up and turned toward us. He greeted Drew with a large grin. He radiated energy, feeding off the general bedlam of the house. Drew said he was impressed with the business, and Dad seemed to grow 6 inches.
"We've been blessed for doing the Lord's work," he said.
The phone rang again. There were at least 3 employees tasked with answering it, but Dad leapt for the receiver as if he'd been waiting for an important call. I'd never seen him so full of life.
"The power of God on earth," he shouted into the mouthpiece. "That's what these oils are. God's pharmacy."
The noise in the house was disorienting, so I took Drew up the mountain. We strolled through fields of wild wheat, and from there into the skirt of pines at the mountain base. The fall colors were soothing, and we stayed for hours, gazing down at the quiet valley. It was late afternoon when we finally made our way back to the house, and Drew left for Salt Lake City. I entered the chapel through the French doors and was surprised by the silence. The house was empty, every phone disconnected, every workstation abandoned. Mother sat alone in the center of the room.
"The hospital called," she said. "Grandma's gone."
My father lost his appetite for the business. He started getting out of bed later and later, and when he did, it seemed it was only to insult or accuse. He shouted at Sean about the junkyard and lectured Mother about her management of the employees. He snapped at Audrey when she tried to make him lunch and barked at me for typing too loudly. It was as if he wanted to fight, to punish himself for the old woman's death. Or perhaps the punishment was for her life, for the conflict that had been between them, which had only ended now she was dead. The house slowly filled again. The phones were reconnected, and women materialized to answer them. Dad's desk remained empty. He spent his days in bed, gazing up at the stucco ceiling. I brought him supper, as I had as a child, and wondered now, as I'd wondered then, whether he knew I was there. Mother moved about the house with the vitality of 10 people, mixing tinctures and essential oils, directing her employees between making funeral arrangements and cooking for every cousin and aunt who dropped in unannounced to reminisce about Grandma. As often as not, I'd find her in an apron, hovering over a roast with a phone in each hand, one a client, the other an uncle or friend calling to offer condolences. Through all this, my father remained in bed. Dad spoke at the funeral. His speech was a 20-minute sermon on God's promises to Abraham. He mentioned my grandmother twice. To strangers, it must have seemed he was hardly affected by the loss of his mother, but we knew better, we who could see the devastation. When we arrived home from the service, Dad was incensed that lunch wasn't ready. Mother scrambled to serve the stew she'd left to slow cook, but after the meal, Dad seemed equally frustrated by the dishes, which Mother hurriedly cleaned, and then by his grandchildren, who played noisily while Mother dashed about trying to hush them. That evening, when the house was empty and quiet, I listened from the living room as my parents argued in the kitchen.
"The least you could do," Mother said, "is fill out these thank you cards. It was your mother, after all."
"That's wifely work," Dad said. "I've never heard of a man writing cards."
He had said the exact wrong thing. For 10 years, Mother had been the primary breadwinner, while continuing to cook meals, clean the house, do the laundry, and I had never once heard her express anything like resentment. Until now.
"Then you should do the husband's work," she said, her voice raised.
Soon they were both shouting. Dad tried to corral her, to subdue her with a show of anger, the way he always had, but this only made her more stubborn. Eventually, she tossed the cards on the table and said,
"Fill them out or don't, but if you don't, no one will."
Then she marched downstairs. Dad followed, and for an hour their shouts rose up through the floor. I'd never heard my parents shout like that, at least not my mother. I'd never seen her refuse to give way. The next morning, I found Dad in the kitchen, dumping flour into a glue-like substance I assumed was supposed to be pancake batter. When he saw me, he dropped the flour and sat at the table.
"You're a woman, ain't you?" he said. "Well, this here's a kitchen."
We stared at each other, and I contemplated the distance that had sprung up between us. How natural those words sounded to his ears, how grating to mine. It wasn't like Mother to leave Dad to make his own breakfast. I thought she might be ill and went downstairs to check on her. I'd barely made it to the landing when I heard it. Deep sobs coming from the bathroom, muffled by the steady drone of a blow dryer. I stood outside the door and listened for more than a minute, paralyzed. Would she want me to leave, to pretend I hadn't heard? I waited for her to catch her breath, but her sobs only grew more desperate. I knocked.
"It's me," I said.
The door opened, a sliver at first, then wider, and there was my mother, her skin glistening from the shower, wrapped in a towel that was too small to cover her. I had never seen my mother so exposed, and instinctively I closed my eyes. The world went black. I heard a thud, the cracking of plastic, and opened my eyes. Mother had dropped the blow dryer, and it had struck the floor, its roar now doubled as it rebounded off the exposed concrete. I looked at her, and as I did, she pulled me to her and held me. The wet from her body seeped into my clothes, and I felt droplets slide from her hair and on to my shoulder. Chapter 33. Sorcery of Physics. I didn't stay long on Buck's Peak, maybe a week. On the day I left the mountain, Audrey asked me not to go. I have no memory of the conversation, but I remember writing the journal entry about it. I wrote it my first night back in Cambridge, while sitting on a stone bridge and staring up at King's College Chapel. I remember the river, which was calm. I remember the slow drift of autumn leaves resting on the glassy surface. I remember the scratch of my pen moving across the page, recounting in detail, for a full 8 pages, precisely what my sister had said. But the memory of her saying it is gone. It is as if I wrote in order to forget. Audrey asked me to stay. Sean was too strong, she said, too persuasive for her to confront him alone. I told her she wasn't alone, she had mother. Audrey said I didn't understand. No one had believed us after all. If we asked Dad for help, she was sure he'd call us both liars. I told her our parents had changed and we should trust them. Then I boarded a plane and took myself 5,000 miles away. If I felt guilty to be documenting my sister's fears from such a safe distance, surrounded by grand libraries and ancient chapels, I gave only one indication of it in the last line I wrote that night. Cambridge is less beautiful tonight. Drew had come with me to Cambridge, having been admitted to a master's program in Middle Eastern studies. I told him about my conversation with Audrey. He was the first boyfriend in whom I confided about my family, really confided, the truth and not just amusing anecdotes. "Of course, all that is in the past," I said. "My family is different now, but you should know, so you can watch me, in case I do something crazy." The first term passed in a flurry of dinners and late-night parties, punctuated by even later nights in the library. To qualify for a PhD, I had to produce a piece of original academic research. In other words, having spent 5 years reading history, I was now being asked to write it. But to write what? While reading for my master's thesis, I'd been surprised to discover echoes of Mormon theology in the great philosophers of the 19th century. I mentioned this to David Runciman, my supervisor.
"That's your project," he said. "You can do something no one has done. You can examine Mormonism not just as a religious movement, but as an intellectual one."
I began to reread the letters of Joseph Smith and Brigham Young. As a child, I'd read those letters as an act of worship. Now, I read them with different eyes, not the eyes of a critic, but also not the eyes of a disciple. I examined polygamy, not as a doctrine, but as a social policy. I measured it against its own aims, as well as against other movements and theories from the same period. It felt like a radical act. My friends in Cambridge had become a kind of family, and I felt a sense of belonging with them that, for many years, had been absent on Buck's Peak. Sometimes I felt damned for those feelings. No natural sister should love a stranger more than a brother, I thought, and what sort of daughter prefers a teacher to her own father? But although I wished it were otherwise, I did not want to go home. I preferred the family I had chosen to the one I had been given, so the happier I became in Cambridge, the more my happiness was made fetid by my feeling that I had betrayed Buck's Peak. That feeling became a physical part of me, something I could taste on my tongue or smell on my own breath. I bought a ticket to Idaho for Christmas. The night before my flight, there was a feast in my college. One of my friends had formed a chamber choir that was to sing carols during dinner. The choir had been rehearsing for weeks, but on the day of the feast, the soprano fell ill with bronchitis. My phone rang late that afternoon. It was my friend.
"Please tell me you know someone who can sing," he said.
I had not sung for years, and never without my father to hear me, but a few hours later, I joined the chamber choir on a platform near the rafters, above the massive Christmas tree that dominated the hall. I treasured the moment, taking pleasure in the lightness I felt to have music once again floating up from my chest, and wondering whether Dad, if he were here, would have braved the university and all its socialism to hear me sing. I believed he would. Buck's Peak was unchanged. The princess was buried in snow, but I could see the deep contours of her legs. Mother was in the kitchen when I arrived, stirring a stew with one hand and with the other holding the phone and explaining the properties of motherwort. Dad's desk was still empty. He was in the basement, Mother said, in bed. Something had hold of his lungs. A burly stranger shuffled through the back door. Several seconds passed before I recognized my brother. Luke's beard was so thick he looked like one of his goats. His left eye was white and dead. He'd been shot in the face with a paintball gun a few months before. He crossed the room and clapped me on the back, and I stared into his remaining eye, looking for something familiar. But it wasn't until I saw the raised scar on his forearm. I remember this as the scar Luke got working the shear. However, it might have come from a roofing accident. A curved checkmark 2 inches wide from where the shear had bitten his flesh, that I was sure this man was my brother. He told me he was living with his wife and a pack of kids in a mobile home behind the barn, making his money working oil rigs in North Dakota. 2 days passed. Dad came upstairs every evening and settled himself into a sofa in the chapel, where he would cough and watch TV or read the Old Testament. I spent my days studying or helping Mother. On the third evening, I was at the kitchen table, reading, when Sean and Benjamin shuffled through the back door. Benjamin was telling Sean about a punch he'd thrown after a fender bender in town. He said that before climbing out of his truck to confront the other driver, he'd slipped his handgun into the waistband of his jeans.
"The guy didn't know what he was getting into," Benjamin said, grinning. "Only an idiot brings a gun into a mess like that," Sean said. "I wasn't going to use it," Benjamin muttered. "Then don't bring it," Sean said. "Then you know you won't use it. If you bring it, you might use it. That's how things are. A fistfight can turn into a gunfight real quick."
Sean spoke calmly, thoughtfully. His blonde hair was filthy and uncut, growing wild, and his face was covered in stubble the color of shale. His eyes shone from under the oil and dirt, blazes of blue in clouds of ash. His expression, as well as his words, seemed to belong to a much older man, a man whose hot blood had cooled, who was at peace. Sean turned to me. I had been avoiding him, but suddenly that seemed unfair. He had changed. It was cruel to pretend he hadn't. He asked if I'd like to go for a drive, and I said I would. Sean wanted ice cream, so we got milkshakes. The conversation was calm, comfortable, like it had been years before on those dusky evenings in the corral. He told me about running the crew without Dad, about Peter's frail lungs, about the surgeries and the oxygen tubes he still wore at night. We were nearly home, only a mile from Buck's Peak, when Sean cranked the wheel and the car skidded on the ice. He accelerated through the spin, the tires caught, and the car leapt onto a side road. "Where are we going?" I asked. But the road only went one place. The church was dark, the parking lot deserted. Sean circled the lot, then parked near the main entrance. He switched off the ignition, and the headlights faded. I could barely make out the curve of his face in the dark.
"You talk much to Audrey?" he said.
"Not really," I said. He seemed to relax. Then he said,
"Audrey is a lying piece of shit."
I looked away, fixing my eyes on the church spire, visible against the light from the stars.
"I'd put a bullet in her head," Sean said,
and I felt his body shift toward me.
"But I don't want to waste a good bullet on a worthless bitch."
It was crucial that I not look at him. As long as I kept my eyes on the spire, I almost believed he couldn't touch me. Almost. Because even while I clung to this belief, I waited to feel his hands on my neck. I knew I would feel them, and soon, but I didn't dare do anything that might break the spell of waiting. In that moment, part of me believed, as I had always believed, that it would be me who broke the spell, who caused it to break. When the stillness shattered and his fury rushed at me, I would know that something I had done was the catalyst, the cause. There is hope in such a superstition. There is the illusion of control. I stayed still, without thought or motion. The ignition clicked. The engine growled to life. Warm air flooded through the vents.
"You feel like a movie?"
Sean said. His voice was casual. I watched the world revolve as the car spun around and lurched back to the highway.
A movie sounds just right, he said.
I said nothing, unwilling to move or speak, lest I offend the strange sorcery of physics that I still believed had saved me. Sean seemed unaware of my silence. He drove the last mile to Buck's Peak, chatting cheerfully, almost playfully, about whether to watch The Man Who Knew Too Little or not. Chapter 34. The Substance of Things. I didn't feel particularly brave as I approached my father in the chapel that night. I saw my role as reconnaissance. I was there to relay information, to tell Dad that Sean had threatened Audrey, because Dad would know what to do. Or perhaps I was calm because I was not there, not really. Maybe I was across an ocean, on another continent, reading Hume under a stone archway. Maybe I was racing through King's College, the Discourse on Inequality tucked under my arm. Dad, I need to tell you something. I said that Sean had made a joke about shooting Audrey, and that I thought it was because Audrey had confronted him about his behavior. Dad stared at me, and the skin where his lips had been tightened. He shouted for Mother, and she appeared. Her mood was somber. I couldn't understand why she wouldn't look me in the eye.
"What exactly are you saying?"
Dad said. From that moment, it was an interrogation. Every time I suggested that Sean was violent or manipulative in any way, Dad shouted at me,
"Where's your proof? Do you have proof?"
"I have journals," I said.
"Get them. I'm going to read them."
"I don't have them with me." This was a lie. They were under my bed.
"What the hell am I supposed to think if you ain't got proof?"
Dad was still shouting. Mother sat on the sofa's edge, her mouth open in a slant. She looked in agony. "You don't need proof," I said quietly. "You've seen it. You've both seen it." Dad said I wouldn't be happy until Sean was rotting in prison, that I'd come back from Cambridge just to raise hell. I said I didn't want Sean in prison, but that some type of intervention was needed. I turned to Mother, waiting for her to add her voice to mine, but she was silent. Her eyes were fixed on the floor, as if Dad and I were not there. There was a moment when I realized she would not speak, that she would sit there and say nothing, that I was alone. I tried to calm Dad, but my voice trembled, cracked. Then I was wailing. Sobs erupted from somewhere, some part of me I had not felt in years, that I had forgotten existed. I thought I might vomit. I ran to the bathroom. I was shaking from my feet to my fingers. I had to strangle the sobs quickly. Dad would never take me seriously if I couldn't, so I stopped the bawling using the old methods, staring my face down in the mirror and scolding it for every tear. It was such a familiar process that in doing it, I shattered the illusion I'd been building so carefully for the past year. The fake past, the fake future, both gone. I stared at the reflection. The mirror was mesmeric, with its triple panels trimmed with false oak. It was the same mirror I'd gazed into as a child, then as a girl, then as a youth, half woman, half girl. Behind me was the same toilet Sean had put my head in, holding me there until I confessed I was a whore. I had often locked myself in this bathroom after Sean let me go. I would move the panels until they showed my face three times, then I would glare at each one, contemplating what Sean had said and what he had made me say, until it all began to feel true instead of just something I had said to make the pain stop. And here I was still, and here was the mirror, the same face repeated in the same three panels. Except it wasn't. This face was older, and floating above a soft cashmere sweater. But Dr. Carey was right. It wasn't the clothes that made this face, this woman, different. It was something behind her eyes, something in the set of her jaw, a hope or belief or conviction that a life is not a thing unalterable. I don't have a word for what it was I saw, but I suppose it was something like faith. I had regained a fragile sense of